item, please.
Item 994, amend marijuana regulatory license procedure and requirements business regulations.
Commissioner Udaly.
Yes, thank you. So, as commissioner in charge of ONI, I'm committed to making sure that Portland's cannabis regulations are flexible, fair, and provide certainty for cannabis business owners. I'm also committed to making sure that Portland has the tools it needs to stand up for our neighbors, our communities, and the legal and regulated cannabis industry. The proposed changes to Portland's cannabis regulations are intended to give cannabis businesses more certainty, to allow business owners to get licensed more quickly, and to allow our staff to more effectively address concerns with the unregulated cannabis market. There are three main changes in this ordinance that ONI staff will present to you today. While these changes are meaningful, they do not reflect the entirety of the work of our office, the mayor's office, and the offices of my colleagues, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Fire Bureau, BDS, and other city bureaus who have been working on this issue for the last several months. We've made it our collective priority to collaborate more closely between city bureaus and to be more responsive to the needs and concerns of cannabis business owners. My office and ONI staff have attended and convened dozens of meetings with cannabis business owners, cannabis industry trade groups, neighborhood groups, city bureaus, and elected officials from the state and federal government to make sure we are listening to and acting on the concerns by those affected by both the regulated and unregulated cannabis industry. The city of Portland and the state of Oregon have a lot of work to do moving forward. As the cannabis industry grows, continues to grow and thrive, there is and will be more that we can do, from supporting efforts to help correct the inequities created by the war on drugs, to providing options for consuming legal cannabis in safe and legal places outside of the home, to providing education and support for small business owners, and protecting the legal and regulated cannabis industry from the unregulated cannabis market. So I want to thank my colleagues for your input and support. I want to thank Bureau staff, in particular Brandon Goldner and Christina Corsi, who are here today to present this update. Also, Mitch Nichols from Bureau of Development Services and Paul Jennings of the Portland Fire Bureau have been really invaluable in this process. And two members of the cannabis industry who have also devoted a lot of time and energy to this process and helping us improve and ensure that Portland's craft cannabis industry is strong, safe, and reflects the values of our community. So now I'm going to turn it over to Brandon Goldner, program specialist with the cannabis program, to give a presentation about the proposed changes. And in the interest of time, we did keep this very brief, but he's certainly prepared to answer any additional questions that may come up. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Brandon Goldner. I'm the program specialist at the City of Portland's Cannabis Program.
Christina Corsi, Cannabis Program Assistant.
And just to start by thanking each of you, your office and your staff, Commissioner Udaly, Commissioner Mayor Wheeler, and Commissioner Frisch. The time that your offices and staff have spent on this issue, I really appreciate it and look forward to working with you in the future. So as Commissioner Udaly said, I do want to keep this as brief as possible. We're going to talk a little bit about the cannabis program background and what we've done in the last 9 months. I'm going to spend the bulk of my time on the specific changes before you today and then talk just a little bit about the future of Portland's cannabis regulations. So we are charged with many different tasks. The way that I try to frame it is that it's a balance. It's a balance between trying to get business owners licensed as quickly as possible, balancing that with public safety and livability. We want to be a resource for the industry and for consumers and for our constituents. We want to provide clear guidelines and expectations. I mean, one thing I've learned in this role is that business owners don't have a clear sense of what the rules are and how to follow them. It makes it very, very difficult to make investments, support their staff, and support their businesses. And just to make clear, too, that as we learn more about what the impacts of local cannabis regulations are and the state cannabis regulations, and as the industry changes, my hope is that we do continue to adapt and change. And that's something that has guided my work in this program for the last 2 years, and I know has guided the work of Commissioner Udaly's office. So I just want to make that point clear. Since January, we have been working very hard to collaborate more closely with the cannabis industry, with our neighbors, and with other city bureaus. We've updated our website, made it easier to navigate. We've added a blog. The Bureau of Development Services released a cannabis industry facilities code guide that was helpful to make sure that people who are trying to get their businesses permitted have a clear and consistent way to do that. We've also been convening meetings with individual cannabis business owners, with trade groups, and have also convened meetings with consultants and business owners, minority cannabis business owners and consultants, trying to think about ways that we can better correct some of the inequities caused by the war on drugs, and began one-on-one meetings with licensees and applicants to ask them, what about this process was difficult? What was tricky? Where were their sticking points? And what can we do to be better? And specifically, we've met with the Oregon Cannabis Association, the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association, Craft Cannabis Alliance, Oregon Cannabis Business Council, and others, provided guidance to temporary events that included consumption of cannabis, which we know with Senate Bill 307 in the last legislative session, it didn't pass, but that is something that is coming on the horizon. And really, again, as I said earlier, trying to coordinate better between our program and our bureau and with the Bureau of Development Services, the Fire Bureau, and other city bureaus that touch on cannabis issues. I don't want to gloss over that BDS began weekly meetings to help specifically with permitting of cannabis businesses. Those meetings were designed to help business owners know exactly how to move forward in their permitting processes, and those have been going on for several months now.
By the way, on go back if you would just for a second. What's been your experience with those weekly meetings? What's attendance like? What has been your sense about the effectiveness? And for those of us who have bureaus that have our own specific issues and challenges where we deal with small businesses, what lessons are we learning about the value of that kind of approach?
Yeah, I think that would be a better question for our representatives from BDS who are convening those meetings. My understanding, just to answer your question directly, I'm not certain those meetings have been attended very robustly. Those meetings are available for people to request. My understanding is that over the last few months, there haven't been many of those meetings requested by the industry. I do think that part of that is if perhaps we'd had something like that in place a few years ago, before some of these businesses got started, we might have seen that utilized more, is my sense. But I think for specific questions about that, you can...
But if I was starting a business and I wanted to come to one of these weekly meetings and kind of do a one-stop shopping and sort of and have all my concerns addressed, that's the goal, right?
Yeah, that's the goal right there for the permitting specifically. So as we're going to talk about some of the changes to our program's requirements with respect to permitting, yes, you're correct. If I were a new producer or a new processor, I could go to the Cannabis Program blog and read more about that or go to BDS's website, sign up for that meeting. As you said, one-stop shop with fire, life safety, and other permitting experts to, just as you said, to help business owners through that process. That's correct.
Commissioner, Mitch couldn't be here today, although he... Oh, I thought I was told you couldn't be here. Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll hear from him a little bit later.
I would love later just because we have a... Like, for example, the Bureau of Environmental Services has a program called the Fats, Oil, Grease Program, and it... It's the FOG program. It has its share of critics in the restaurant industry, and we're always thinking about what's the best way to interface with people. What's the most efficient use of our time, their time, and how do we help people learn about not only how to get through all the regulatory hoops, but learn about our discount programs, our financing programs, and other kinds of things. So I look forward to hearing some more later from your experience.
Thank you, Commissioner.
We set these meetings up just to address kind of the immediate concerns and issues with the cannabis industry, but we're also bringing back the small business liaison at BDS to help some of the folks that you're talking about. So,
thank you,
Brandon.
All right, let's go into the changes and There are three major changes. There are also some minor definition cleanup that is not substantive, just to keep consistency with the OLCC. But the three major changes are delineating between processor license types, allowing retailers who are open and licensed to remain open and licensed if a school moves within their 1,000-foot buffer, and allowing the cannabis program the ability to inspect applicants and not just licensees. Before I chat about this first change, which I believe is the most substantive change, I want to make this very clear. Any changes that we make to our program, or frankly whether or not our program exists at all, in no way affects the requirements and policies of the Fire Bureau, of BDS, of Oregon Structural Code, or anything else. So when we're talking about these changes, we're just talking about the cannabis program's licensing requirements. So delineating between processor license types, the OLCC has four endorsement types to kind of break down what type of processing is that business doing: topicals, edibles, concentrates, and extracts. Extracts are the processes that may use substances like butane, hexane, or propane that are can be very dangerous and carry a significantly greater level of potential risk. So in order to reflect that that risk is greater with that particular kind of processor, what this change would do is it would allow for processors of topicals, edibles, or concentrates to get a license with us before all of their building permitting and associated trade permits have been finaled. They still need to show that those permits have been applied for, to show that they are in process of getting them. And it's also true that upon renewal a year later, all of those folks will have to show that the permits have been finaled out. So what this does is it allows the kinds of processors that carry a relatively lower level of potential risk to get licensed with our program a little bit faster. This is similar to the change that you all considered, well, a different council considered in December, when it removed retailers, dispensaries, and wholesalers from that permitting requirement for the same reasons, because they carried a different level of potential risk and we wanted to get those folks licensed faster. And again, I want to repeat that this in no way changes the requirements from the Fire Bureau or BDS, and just affects our program's licensing requirements. So for that, do you have any questions about that?
I have just one. Yeah. And I know Chris Denberg could have been more engaged with you from my office on this. But in my recollection is the last time we talked about this, this was conceptual. I'm just curious to know what the response of the industry was to delineating between these different types of processors.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. We do have some business owners from the cannabis industry signed up to testify on these changes, and they can give you their feedback. But my sense is that most folks appreciate this change, again, because it does reflect that those kinds of processors carry a lower level of potential risk and will get them licensed faster. So my sense is that that change will be received well.
Very good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
So I have a question. The house that blew up by Peninsula Park, was that a cannabis business or a cannabis processing business?
No, it was not. That was a residential home. It was someone who was processing with cans of butane. To the best of my recollection, they were puncturing those cans of butane in a process called open blast processing, which is extraordinarily unsafe, not condoned by the state, not condoned by the city. So that was not a business. That was
completely illegal.
It was somebody trying to amend cannabis. It was a cannabis.
Yeah, it was an individual who was attempting to process cannabis in a dangerous way. That's correct, but they were not a business.
And which of the four categories, if they had been in doing it?
They would have been an extract processor, so they would have been at highest level of potential risk. But I do want to make clear that from what I've seen, the cannabis industry, the business owners, are using closed-loop systems, which are much, much, much safer. But it's still true that because they're using those dangerous substances, we want to keep those folks in a higher-level category of risk, which is why they're not included in these changes. Any other questions on this particular change? Okay, moving on. Changing our rules to allow for retailers to continue operating if they've gotten licensed and a school opens within 1,000 feet of their buffer. This is a change that has already been made in statute at the state level, and so the city would like to follow suit. There are two exceptions to this rule. One, if you're a retailer who has been essentially grandfathered under this provision and your license is revoked for some reason and you need to reapply, you would not be allowed to continue operating within that buffer. And similarly, if there's an ownership change of 51% or more, as with the state also requires this, you'd need to apply with a new application and therefore would not be grandfathered. But what this does, it allows business owners who've made investments in their businesses, infrastructure investments, staffing investments, to continue operating even if later, after they've been licensed, a school opens up within their buffer. Again, this is just a change to match how the state is approaching this particular issue. Any questions on that? Okay. And finally, allowing the cannabis program the ability to inspect applicants and not just licensees. Right now, part of our process to get a license with us is that you do have to get an inspection of your facility to make sure that it's safe and that you've met our code requirements. But this will also allow our program to have a little bit of an easier time with inspecting folks who may be operating as a cannabis business outside of that regulation, and so we can better protect the legal and regulated industry from that unregulated activity. I do want to make clear that this change would not allow staff to come into your business without your permission. What we have in existing code language is if that were the case, if we would request to inspect someone's facility and they didn't want to let us in, we would have to obtain an administrative warrant and go down that route. But again, this does reflect that if someone is performing the activities of a cannabis business or has applied with our program, it does give us the authority to say, hey, our code language allows us to request us to inspect your facility, and you know, could you please let us in? So that is the third change.
I'm sorry to jump around. Could I go back to the prior slide? So first of all, I'll be very clear. I support this proposed change. And I appreciate the fact that you've grandfathered in operating businesses. I'm a little more squeamish about the second part of this, which is, should there be a change in ownership, and if a school locates within 1,000 feet, they're required to reapply, but in practicality, they're not going to get a license to operate now that there's a school within 1,000 feet. Has this cleared some legal threshold? I mean, I assume that since the state already enacted this, at some point the legislative legal counsel chimed in on this. This doesn't constitute a taking?
Mayor, I'm not the lawyer on this, but because it's a grandfather, the benefit accrues to the person who would otherwise be subject to the hardship. A new owner is in effect a stranger to that hardship, and would come in with eyes open and could make that judgment. So there's no taking. But the idea is a grandfather focuses the benefit on the party that has an inequitable outcome because of something they didn't foresee.
Well, you can't sell a business that won't have a right to operate. So it's not actually the new owner who bears that financial risk. It's the current owner who we've already grandfathered in who bears that financial risk.
Mayor,
or do I have that wrong?
I shared your concerns, and I don't believe we have a choice. I think this is as per state.
Yeah, and I want to make
rules.
Two points. You're correct, and I called the OLCC again this morning just to quadruple check this, that yes, if their ownership at the state level changes by 51% or more, they also would not be allowed to continue operating if a school had been moved into their buffers. So that's the first point. And the second point would be that if folks sell their business, the license isn't transferred with that. So if I'm a business owner and I get a license with ONI, I can certainly sell my business, but that new owner would have to reapply with our program. The people who are associated with that business would have to declare who they are, things of that nature. So it would be treated much like a new application.
Okay. Well, I want to be completely transparent, though. If it's a new application, we're going to deny it, right?
Correct.
Under this rule. I mean, the rule states very clearly that we would deny it under
Correct.
Those circumstances.
Yeah, so the rule really is for the benefit.
So in part, what we're trying to do here is make this in sequence with state law.
But
Correct.
We deny the license for that location, Mayor. It's
yeah,
no different
relocate.
Than if we had a change in zoning and someone had to move to a different location. We don't guarantee a zip code, but it does not prevent
That's
you
right.
from operating a business.
Looks like the city attorney might have a comment.
I was just going to comment that prior to this, the state of the law was that it was, you know, it was a crime, a state crime, to have, you know, to grow marijuana within 1,000 feet of the school. And so the issue came, my understanding is the issue arose when people started a business and then a school moved into the location and then all of a sudden they don't have their business anymore. So I think the law was changed to allow for existing businesses, but unless and until state law changed to then allow for a subsequent purchaser of that business to also act within 1,000 feet of a school, then they're going to have that issue of violating state criminal laws.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that, that's where that change came about, why the change came about initially, and then what you're facing.
Realistically, there's a test to be had here, right?
Right.
I mean, isn't that the truth? Somebody at some point is going to have to test this.
Well, I'll just state a contrary view. I'm a little squeamish about having one of these businesses 1,000 feet from a school. I mean, I have a middle schooler. There are reasons we have buffers from schools for certain kinds of activity. But it seems to me an inequity to say to someone who's played by the rules and a school moves in that they would otherwise be subject to a criminal sanction or some other forfeiture.
Seems pretty hard.
So I appreciate the idea of grandfathering that person. And if there's a subsequent change in law, we can come back and decide whether we want the benefit to extend beyond the party who's grandfathered.
That's great. All right. Good. Thank you, Mary.
On the same topic, could I just have a follow-up question? That is, what's happening as far as education? Because my understanding is from some parents in middle schools and high schools is that there's a lot of use by youth. And the state was supposed to be doing some education. Our program was supposed to be doing some education. So what's the status of that, please?
Yeah, we've collaborated in the past with Multnomah County and their public health division on education. And really, the county has taken much of the lead on the education component. I think that moving forward that we certainly can do a better job of that education outreach here in Portland, and that's something I'm very open to discussing and to putting into action, yes.
Since we're on camera right now, people under 25 are really strongly recommended not to use cannabis because of the brain damage that can happen for people up until that age. So there's good scientific evidence behind it, and I hope that parents, teachers, and the community as a whole will be having more discussions about this. Thank you for helping with that.
So I have a question off the next slide. So the mayor took you back one. Let's go forward one. And you're going to feel like you have whiplash. I didn't quite follow what you said about not having the authority to perform an inspection without consent and then the need to get a administrative subpoena.
No.
And I guess I just can I have a I'd like to know a little bit more about the legal rights that we're seeking to protect there.
Well, so normally you wouldn't have a right to search, as you know, of course, anybody's the personal. I mean, you could go into any public areas, but you couldn't go into any private areas without consent of the owner. And so generally we'll come up with a process where we will be able to get an administrative warrant if we feel that there's some reason that they're violating one of our policies or codes that would apply to them.
And what qualifies as private space? We're talking about someone's home or their...
Well, so for example, the area that may not be open to the public. So if we have the front area where I'm selling things that's open to the public, you can come into that area and you can look around all you want. But let's say there's a back area where you're packaging things or other things sort that you may not... The public wouldn't have access to, and therefore we wouldn't just automatically have access to.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Any other questions on the last slide? Okay. So just to wrap up, there's a lot crammed onto this slide, but I want to take one moment. The future of our program, having a public involvement process, the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team, which in the past has been made up of community and industry members, I'm looking forward to getting that back up and running now that ONI has a new director, and with her input and the input of the commissioner's office, getting that back up and running. We supported Senate Bill 307, which would have created a regulatory framework for social consumption, which I believe is something that will perhaps be considered by the legislature next session and that we would continue to advocate for as well. And along with the meetings we've had with minority cannabis business owners, to convene meetings with women-owned business owners and consultants to talk about the challenges that they're facing in this industry. Because frankly, when you look at who is benefiting from this new legal industry, it is dominated by mostly white males. And what can Portland do to change that is something our program cares very deeply about. And we also want to seek to meaningfully lower those barriers to entry to make sure that people have all the education, the resources, the coordination, the convening power, everything they need to be successful as a business owner to protect our legal craft cannabis industry here in Oregon and in Portland, and to disincentivize the illegal cannabis market. And again, you know, just to end, I want to thank you all for your time. And I know that these issues can be tricky, and it's a tough balance to strike sometimes, and we are trying our very best to strike that balance appropriately. If you had any other questions for either myself or Christina, we'd be happy to take them.
Very good. We'll go to public testimony, and you can cool your heels for a while.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Thank you for the presentation. How many people do we have signed up, Carla?
I show seven.
Seven. Very good. 3 minutes each. Name for the record. We don't need anybody's address.
Okay. The first three are Al Ochoa, Casey Honlihan, and Peter Ratched.
Good afternoon, if you'd like to start.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. My name is Al Ochoa. I'm the Director of Licensing and Corporate Relations for Cura Cannabis. We're an OLCC-licensed processor and wholesaler with multiple facilities here in the city of Portland. First off, thank you, commissioners and mayor, and especially the team at ONI for bringing this forward. As a company, as an industry, we definitely appreciate all the efforts in helping alleviate some of the pressures that a lot of the folks in the industry have been having. I've actually had, as director of licensing, I've had an intimate relationship with ONI and with BDS. Been here since day one back in 2015. You know, dealing with a lot of the licensing issues. I actually would have been here to testify back in December when the retailer and wholesaler ordinance was passed, but because of that snowstorm, wasn't able to come in. But I've been actually advocating, not only as a company, but me personally, for an amendment like this. I've been to several CPOP meetings over the last year, and this was, again, one of those things that I've always pushed because I always felt that there should have been some sort of delineation between the different types of processors. Down in California, for example, they actually have a manufacturing license where they split it up between volatile versus non-volatile. A lot of the hydrocarbon-based solvent extractors down there are considered volatile, whereas everybody else, from the people that mix cannabis oil with chocolate or that fill cannabis oil into vape cartridges, those are considered non-volatile. So I definitely think this is a good step forward for the industry. It's going to allow people to get licensed faster. I know there's a lot of people that have been struggling to pay bills and things because of a lot of the delays at BDS. So I'm glad these things are happening, and I do hope that we go ahead and pass this ordinance, again, to strike the balance between business longevity but also public safety and the safety of cannabis company employees as well. So again, this is a good step forward, but there's still lots of things to do, and I definitely urge you to go ahead and look at approving this ordinance.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Casey Houlihan. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We're a trade association that represents over 200 cannabis businesses across the state of Oregon, many of whom are located within the city of Portland. I serve as the group's executive director. As you well know, many of our folks in the city of Portland are directly subject to the policies created by the city and the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. Our members include retailers, producers, wholesalers, processors, as well as a slew of other ancillary businesses operating in the state's fastest-growing economic sector. A great many of our members who are not located inside the city of Portland have also felt the impacts of the city's policies indirectly, and it's with that statewide impact in mind that we reach out to you today about some of the pressing issues facing our industry and our members. Portland-based businesses play such a major role in our statewide cannabis economy that some of the licensing delays for processors within the city of Portland have resulted in major shortages of processed and value-added products from our store shelves, which in turn has driven up the wholesale price for what few processed products are available. More often than not, the snags in city licensing these businesses are hitting make it impossible for them to begin operating and generating revenue, so many are bled dry of their initial financing until they're forced to close. The single biggest complaint that we've heard from folks navigating this process has been just the capricious nature of it as they navigate the different agencies and find it to be so siloed and the communication lacking from one between the other. We feel very strongly that today's proposed changes will help provide more certainty for the folks trying to start out in the cannabis industry at present, and it'll allow so many to finally begin operating. By delineating between the license types for processors, our agencies have the necessary discretion to allow these businesses to operate so long as there's no public safety concern presented by their operations. Previously, the one-size-fits-all approach to zoning and occupancy that had been taken by agencies like the Bureau of Development Services was the cause for a great many businesses to be held up during licensing. And this new way of differentiating licenses and applicants based on the specific level of risk their model poses to the community is far more sensible. Additionally, we strongly support the proposed change to update the city's licensing rules for cannabis retailers to allow a previously licensed facility to have its license renewed in the event that a school moves within 1,000 feet of their location. This technical fix was done by both the legislature and the OLCC in recent years. We strongly urge the city of Portland to do the same. I'd like to echo some of Mayor Wheeler's concerns about instances where a shop may change hands, but I do think that this is the right track for us to be on for these conversations moving forward, and we may well have to wait for a test case to make itself known. Lastly, one area where the legal cannabis industry very much still needs some help from the city of Portland is combating the impact of the illicit market. And there are massive amounts of illicit market cannabis in Portland that can easily be found for sale through popular websites like Craigslist and Facebook, and this undermines our state's licensed businesses that are playing by the rules. The reach of the illicit market here in Portland is ubiquitous, and worse, sellers are not checking ID to ensure customers are at least 21. Products are not tested for potency or safety. Taxes are not collected on those sales. And where the money goes to profit drug dealers rather than our K-12 education system, our law enforcement, and our drug treatment and prevention programs. We really appreciate you taking the time to explore this issue. We strongly support the changes, and I'm happy to answer any questions you all may have.
Great, thank you. I just have one question. You mentioned the illicit market. I'm just curious, given some of the statements coming out of the Justice Department in Washington, have any of the, at least at the rhetorical level, has any of that had any kind of measurable impact on your industry?
Well, there are different illicit markets that the state has a challenge with, the first being the out-of-state export illicit market.
No, I mean, I'm separate and apart from the illicit market. I'm talking about what our federal attorney general has been saying generally about cannabis. Has that had any chilling effect on that you've discerned in your industry?
I think it's fair to say that yes, to some extent, and certainly one of the things that's been a great sense of relief and comfort to folks in the industry has been that our governor and our executive branch here in Oregon, Kate Brown, has made it a point to defend our regulatory system for cannabis businesses so robustly and to ensure that the legislative fixes have been in there in recent sessions to make sure that we do have a very strong seed-to-sale tracking system in place. So when we are having those conversations with the federal DOJ, we can point to our system and show that this is not causing leakage into the out-of-state illicit market, which seems to be their primary concern.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Rock with Farmers Friends Extracts, LLC. We are a Portland-based small business. We are a cannabis processor with all of our endorsements. We were the first business to be actually licensed in the city of Portland by OHA. We are given the first initial medical processor license. We do differentiate that we are CO2 only. So when you bring up processors, or when Oni brought up processors between butane, propane, alcohol, CO2 is definitely a differential in there. When we think of extract processors, not the three other topical, edible, and concentrate processors, we think of extraction in a few different ways, and being bulked in with volatile substances or volatile chemicals for extraction is how we had to differentiate ourselves in order to operate in the city of Portland, where at the time barriers were that high. So in order for us to do every one of the endorsements, we had to choose. We can never touch anything butane, propane, anything close to that. So getting BDS, ONI, and the fire chief's office all on the same page with the recommendation that CO2 is not volatile, that we use heat and pressure and not volatile substance to chemically cut, was a big victory. Everybody collaborated and said, well, these huge fire extinguishers that we have to have per mandate for permitting on our walls is the same stuff we're putting in to actually do our processes. So I hope that everybody realizes or at least accepts that when you talk about the extractors, which are the highest risk, when it comes to the processing types, that there is a differential between those. And because we were CO2 only, we were able to navigate the system effectively and get issued licenses and our certificate of occupancy. We definitely see the differentiating of the endorsement types being non-organic, to say. It happened because we all went through the same process of learning together, and we saw what the market will and won't take. It wasn't a concerted effort by lobbying groups or even by small business owners to try to do this. Unfortunately, one of the biggest failures and one of the things that Portland actually wants is great topicals, edibles, concentrate processors. It's the extraction that would pose the risk we're talking about here. And I think that with the patients and the new updates and evolution to city guidelines, we're going to see a lot more of those businesses come back in because there is that natural update to what processors are and what endorsements are needed. And so we found we fully support this because it's naturally happening. It's who could first survive and get all these things out of necessity, and now what does the market really want, and how are we going to encourage businesses to come back in here and say, all right, we know the rules. We now have effective places to get information and collaborate and go through this process together where we all had to do it together, and when everybody's coming from it, from BDS, ONI, fire marshal, small business, or large business, there wasn't the opportunity for collaboration. It was more so, let's do this together, let's stumble together, and let's work with each other. And I think now the collaboration is coming between government agencies and business owners that wasn't there beforehand because we've all finally gotten our experience together. So we look forward to more of that collaboration.
Thank you. Perfectly timed, by the way. And this is really interesting, and I had one question. What are the trade-offs, then, between using a CO2-based process as you do versus one of the more volatile processes? Why isn't everybody just using the CO2?
I think it depends on your cost-volume-profit analysis when you go into business. I think scientifically, when you can extract something using a chemical cut, you might be able to create a larger volume that you can use as margin. Let's just give an example. If you're using a BHO or PHO process on the exact same organic inputs, you may get 20 to 25% of a crude yield from that. Using CO2 and only heat and pressure and not a chemical solvent to cut the extract, you can only get so much of that. So usually it ranges anywhere from 10 to less than 10, depending on the input types. So because of that, why wouldn't you want a 20% yield to be able to put into more value-added products or put into the market versus getting a less yield if you can? I mean, that's a smart business that almost every other industry would say, yes, we'd want a larger yield in order to decide what we would like to do with it going forward and how to utilize this in our system. We saw the cost, volume, profit differently and said, well, we want to do it this way. We know that this is safe. This will always be a food or instrumental grade process, and we won't have to worry about the same risk factors that I think extractors that do the other part of the endorsements would find. It's just that's what we saw, and we tried to look forward and not in the current moment, which a lot of businesses didn't get the opportunity to do. We can either survive doing this, mm-hmm. or we are going to have to shut down, and a lot of people, yield matters and margin matters. We just found that it was more pragmatic to look at it in one different way.
That's actually very interesting, and I appreciate that. It sort of reminds me of volumes versus organics in the dairy business, but it's an interesting differentiation.
I mean, realistically, as much as we don't like to talk about it, marijuana will be treated as a commodity. We're going to be folded into the same cycle as every business. As much as we like to think we're pushing boundaries and creating a new industry that will change the way everything happens, I think most pragmatists and sound business people will say, no, we're going to be folded in. That only comes with accepting what rules are there, how to operate within them, and not, for lack of a better word, having as much chip on your shoulder. It's about starting fresh and going, we want to learn the processes we've never been subject to. Fortunately for us, we weren't in the marijuana industry before that. We started fresh, and we were seeing the opportunity for what it was and the value we could bring to it.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks, all three of you.
Thank you, guys, for
your testimony. Next three, please, Carla.
Are Logan Leachman, Miranda Weigler, and Laura Valden.
Good afternoon. Why don't you go ahead and start for us, please?
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Logan Leachman. I'm here on behalf of Emerge Law Group. Just here in downtown, we represent cannabis industry across the board, retailers, processors, wholesalers, producers, and some medical that still exists. I first wanted to echo the comments made with regard to ONI with their tireless work. I represent clients all across the state, and in no other jurisdiction have I seen the kind of positive interactions actually listening to the industry that the city of Portland through ONI has actually accomplished. Most jurisdictions have gotten more regressive, and I feel that Portland is completely the opposite, allowing more participation in the industry from a broader range of participants. So I wanted to echo the support for the first proposed change regarding permitting. I understand that is a fantastic change on behalf of processors, and it will benefit the industry overall. I wanted to echo the support with slight reservation about the second change, and I think this mirrors kind of some of your comments, Mayor Wheeler, in that the statutory language differs slightly from this proposed ordinance, in that the statutory language is broader and requires an OLCC interpretation to get at that the requirement that a new owner would not be able to take advantage of this grandfathering. It is not explicit in the statute there, and so OLCC could change their interpretation or could interpret differently based on the situation. So as you were saying, I think that it would be appropriate in the language, in the code language here, to say that when a new application was required, but tying it to the 50% requirement, I think is it gets a little bit too specific in this instance, where there are some situations I could foresee where there could be a change in 50% ownership or more that OLCC would not require a new application, where ONI may not require a new application, but if this language were codified, it would trigger that requirement based on the objective and rather than the subjective standard.
Can I ask you a question? Because I want to make sure I understand the context for this. Currently, how many licensees are impacted by this change we're proposing? So how many businesses are there that are being that potentially can be grandfathered in? Because I'm guessing it's a very small universe, or maybe I'm missing something.
The universe of licensees that could be impacted by this is potentially every licensee, since this is for a future event, right? If a school moves in within 1,000 feet of your existing license, well, a school could move in within 1,000 feet of almost any existing retail license.
Okay. Well,
charter school, including charter schools and private schools.
Charter schools, public
and public schools. And private
schools.
Yeah.
Essentially anything that meets the compulsory education requirement under state law.
So any change prospective potentially impacts a current licensee. So you're saying that there's a we can't quantify it because there's a number of scenarios where someone could do a satellite school, a new school, whatever.
And every existing retailer,
by definition, would not have been something that a licensee anticipated because it happens sometime in the future.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
But I want to further understand what you're saying. The state doesn't talk about 50% or more. It becomes more of a discretionary review by OLCC.
The language in the statute that references that was adopted as part of House Bill 3400 that references if the eventuality if a school were to move in within 1,000 feet of a retailer does not specifically mention anything about a new application, actually. The way that this was interpreted is OLCC pays particular attention to indefinite versus definite articles and statutes. And so in this particular statute, it says the retailer may continue to operate. And so in those situations, OLCC typically interprets the retailer to mean the same retailer instead of a retailer.
Yeah, so one question I'll have, Commissioner, maybe Brandon could be thinking about it, is if there's a couple who own a business, they have three children, they decide that they're going to give it to their three children, then that would then be a change in ownership according to this language that we've got in our code.
Correct. And the example I was using earlier when I was thinking about this was, say, the two of us go into business together. You are the 80% owner. I'm the 20% owner. You want to shift your role and basically, we switch places, right? You become the 20% owner, I become the 80% owner. If this were codified with the 50% requirement, that would require a new application and we would lose that business.
Thank you for explaining. We'll have to talk about that.
So I'm not averse to changing the language. We really just want to mirror state law. Mm-hmm. My concern is I want clarity for that potential buyer because if you buy a business, I mean, the location and lease is a significant part of the value of a business. I mean, you can buy the contents and you can, you know, the branding and everything that comes with it. That would be my concern right now. If we don't have clarity, someone buys a business, reapplies for the license, and then is informed that they cannot continue to operate in that location. Do you have any thoughts on would walk that line?
Commissioner, I mean, this is a complicated subject, and I think it requires us to do more than on the fly.
Yeah.
But the point that you just made of someone changing the ownership mix, either because of tax reasons, estate planning, changes within families, those kinds of things, I would treat that whole category differently than the sale to some third party. So to me, what you've just described, that could be guided, again, by tax issues, family issues, disputes within families, long-term planning, estate planning, I would look at that differently, and would hate to see that there's a legal impediment to doing those kinds of things, which may be for the long-term health of the business, versus the decision to sell to Mayor Wheeler, which, you know, arm's length. And so I would want to...
Plan B.
So I'd want to better understand that distinction, because I, to me, they feel different.
Correct. And to address both comments, first, Commissioner Fish, your comments, I think to some extent our hands are tied by state statute and by OLCC's interpretation of same. If OLCC will not give us a license, then this exercise is moot. Basically, you know, we could have all the ONI licenses in the world. If without the OLCC license, the state would come in and shut us down. Commissioner Udaly, to respond to your comments, I think that the key here would be to, as it says, mirror the statute as much as possible. In that way, we could ensure that the city's interpretation and enforcement and application is the same as OLCC's. And then overall, when we're talking about investment-backed expectations of businesses, as part of due diligence, and we have seen a number of these transactions start to take place already. Businesses have either, you know, lost their will to keep trying or just had a really short-term exit strategy or various other reasons. But in the due diligence period, we would determine whether that, you know, this would be triggered, whether we could get a new license, because it would require the school to have moved in already. If I purchase and then the school moves in, well, then I'm now the licensee and I'm protected there. So I think that would be discovered during due diligence and would be easily discovered as long as we have clear statutory and ordinance language.
Makes sense.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the platform. My name is Miranda Weigler. I'm the owner and CEO of Little House Foods, a cannabis processing company in Portland, in Northwest Portland, recently licensed by the OLCC. And I came today because I am one of the businesses specifically impacted by this proposal, and I wanted to come and say thank you for the conversation. Thank you to ONI for all the hard work that they do, and thank you to Commissioner Udaly's office for the work that they've been doing, especially listening to businesses and trade associations when we've brought up this issue. We are a processing company that uses no solvents whatsoever. It took 6 months to find the space that we use, specifically because we recognize we cook. We needed a type 1 hood. We have grease-laden vapors, and that is the threat that we pose. So spending 6 months to find a space that is far away from schools and in the right places and has all the security potential in it was already an odyssey. It was difficult when we came to compliance pieces, trying to educate each successive individual within BDS with the different pieces about the differences within processor types, that we don't use solvents, that we don't use closed loop, that all we do is cook. And as a result, because of this confusion, Our process was longer, much more confusing, and it is difficult to remain patient when you see your bank account just draining without the possibility of any income, and seeing the illicit businesses continue to profit, to pose a threat, to be a stigma on those of us who are trying to operate legally. So today, I just wanted to come and say thank you for the conversation. Hugely in support of this differentiation within different processor types, because we want to be safe businesses. We want to be contributing. We want to pay taxes. We want to have it go to all the right places and make sure that children are safe and that we're doing this in an intelligent way. But that's really what I'm here today to do. Great. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, colleagues. Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Valden. I am a business owner here in Portland. For the last 3 years, I own a licensed processing facility here in North Portland. And I came to discuss with you guys just my support for this. I think, you know, I had a different situation than you did. I started my... So when we arrived into this community 3 years ago and started our business, we knew that we would have to deal with the permitting issues. And so we really began the conversation with BDS very early on before the licensing even took effect. And so our process with BDS only took about 10 months, which I think is not that bad for a regulatory body that didn't have a lot of education about marijuana. We make edibles and concentrates, and we did have rare large machinery that is complicated and hard to explain. Although it does not use high heat or pressure, we do not use CO2. We do use isopropyl alcohol. And so we did go through the concentrate issues with the fire department and with BDS pretty extensively. But I did find that we could easily access and educate them through the gap in knowledge with the appeals and waiver process. And so I think because we applied back in January 2016 for BDS approval and for final certificate of occupancy, it didn't affect our licensing. But I do think that if you're not starting that process early on, you are going to face significant impediments. And that is the story that I hear from people in my position as a board member for the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. I participate there as their board member, and I hear from membership constantly about the impediments to doing business in Portland. And I mean phone calls and emails, and it's pretty excessive, the problems that people are having, and most of them are not extractors. And so I think it's important for the council to consider that a lot of these people pose little to no risk. They are doing things like any other restaurant or catering kitchen or manufacturing facility in general, and many of them do not process extensively or with machinery. And so you really are talking about a group of people who just want to do business. And it's so important right now, considering the great impediments in the Portland area. We want this industry to grow. We want it to be successful. And the true issue and the true gap in knowledge is with extraction machinery. Those are the things that BDS does not have a lot of information about and needs to do more extensive looks at hoods and safety and electric. And so those people should really, I think, be subjected, you know, to the longer waits and greater overhaul so that we can have safe facilities. We need the public to be safe. So it's very important to delineate that and keep that separate. So thank you for all your hard work. Thank you for listening to us and having us here today. I appreciate it.
Next three, please, Carla.
I have one more left.
One more.
Tony Birch.
Very good.
Oh, boy.
Good afternoon.
Hey there. My name's Tony Birch. I own a processing company here in Portland, Oregon. We have a concentrate endorsement. We are one of the first processors licensed in the city. So I'm here today to give a visual of a concentrate piece of machinery. As the woman before me explained, there's a kind of a gap in knowledge between concentrate equipment and extract equipment. This is a piece of concentrate equipment. It plugs into your wall. It sits on top of your table. It's got these heating pads here that are pretty much the same plates on a hair straightener. These plates come together and they squish, and it squishes out this oil, and that's it. There's no flame, there's no pressure, there's no hydrocarbons, there's no chemicals. It's all natural. when we were going through the licensing process, we were getting grouped into the same category as extractors, which is very frustrating because they're comparing this type of equipment to equipment that's exploding, that's combustible, flammable, you name it. This is clearly not that type of equipment. So I just wanted to give a visual of what this type of equipment really is and how low impact something like this is. Kind of the analogy, and it's very rudimentary, so bear with me. It's kind of like a building. You're not going to have someone that's building a 100-square-foot shed pull the same permits as someone that's building a large building in downtown. They're very different, though they fall under the same umbrella of a building. They've got a roof, they've got walls, but they're very different. This is very different than the equipment that's used with the extracts, but yet it still falls under the same category because it makes a similar product. So I was just here today to explain those differences. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Very good. Colleagues, did we want to bring staff up?
Yeah, I think we should do that.
Very good.
So Mitch Nichols is joining us after all. I think... the biggest question is around aligning our language with the state language and the 1,000-foot exception.
Yeah. So I can have a conversation with our city attorney contact just to chat about that particular issue, and I can loop back as quick as I can. Because, the intent there was to be consistent with the state. There would be a separate consideration, though, because there are times when potentially the city code would want to go above and beyond what the state is requiring. That was not my intent in this case. But if, for example, if council saw it compelling that they would want to limit that landscape to prevent that grandfathering, that may be a consideration that you make. But if your intention was the same as mine, just to mirror what the state was doing, then yes, I can work with our city attorney on changing that language to reflect that intent.
That sounds great. And this is a non-emergency first reading, so we can introduce an amendment next week.
Is that enough time? Because the alternative would be to just pull that piece out that's on the rest and bring it back later.
It seems relatively minor to me, unless we think we're going to need to have a more in-depth conversation.
Commissioner Fish?
Well, I actually think this discussion, this is why we have public hearings. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I think the issues have been framed very thoughtfully. I would urge us to move forward to a second reading. If we have an amendment next week that's teed up, we can slap an emergency clause on the whole thing and pass it. If it turns out there is a policy discussion debate, then I think this is a very discreet issue that could come back for a surgical debate at ASAP. I like the idea, though, of getting this new regulatory framework in place. And then if we want to tweak it, let's tweak it. And I'm open to tweaking it. I heard some very thoughtful arguments today.
Why don't we do this then? Why don't we move it to second? And then that gives us a week to think about the strategy going forward on that particular issue.
Sure. Just ask a question.
Sure.
It's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
How does it work for other non-conforming uses? So are they grandfathered? Is the use grandfathered, or is it just for the life of the current owner, another business would get grandfathered for whatever reason?
From a grandfather perspective, and this is to the best of my knowledge, I'm not a zoning professional with the city, but from my understanding, the use is grandfathered, the occupancy of the structure is grandfathered until such time as a change, a trigger is enacted by virtue of either a permitting process or a licensing process or a zoning change in that area. So when we change, we overlay, do an overlay of a zone, and a new zone is created. The existing businesses or structures in that are otherwise non-compliant are considered non-conforming, pre-existing non-conforming, and they're allowed to continue in that capacity until they're either destroyed by more than, I think, 50% of the value of the structure, or there's another trigger, like a seismic upgrade or something to that effect, that is required for them to modify their building.
But selling the property and continuing that use is not one of those things, right? It's not
true. That is typically it. The grandfather stays with the property.
So, colleagues, throughout our work on the cannabis business, we've tried to treat them as much similarly as other businesses as possible. So I realize that there's state law on this particular one, but to the extent that we can grandfather the use, because if the school chooses to go there, they shouldn't be just counting on eventually this business is going to change hands. You know, they go into the area with their eyes wide open.
Well, so I'm certainly open to the broadest possible grandfather based on this discussion. And if legal counsel tells us that the goalposts are narrower, I'm particularly interested in not putting up impediments to people who are changing ownership structure based on things like tax laws or estate planning or other reasons, because that seems to me to be form over substance.
Yeah, and just to speak to what Commissioner Daly said a little bit ago, making sure that businesses know what the requirements are at the state and the city level, if we were to move forward with that piece of it that didn't have any of the clarifying language, it just said that you could be grandfathered, we would just have to do a good job of communicating with the applicant, hey, if the state says you can't get licensed, remember that you need that state license in order to operate in the city. And I think that's just a communication issue that we can certainly address.
Great. Well,